hoped he wouldn't want to meet Thursday. At USC, anyone who misses a final exam fails the course. Elliot replied right back. Can you meet at 8 a.m. in Long Beach on Thursday in the lobby of the Renaissance Hotel? Sorry to make you come so far. I'm at a conference here. And you should read, when I stop talking, you'll know I'm dead. And get to the part about the Star of Artaban before we meet. Maybe it's a chapter or two in. You'll love the book. Go on The Price is Right, not study for finals. Meet Elliot, risk missing a final. It was as if someone was playing a video game of my life, sitting back, laughing, and flinging banana peels at my feet. Each impossible decision was a checkpoint, testing to see where my heart truly was. For the first time, though, I didn't hesitate. Chapter 9. The Rules. 2 days later, I sat on a couch in the middle of the hotel lobby, glancing between my watch and the main entrance. If our meeting lasted 20 minutes, and it took half an hour to get back to school, that gave me 2 hours to cram before my final. And if our meeting lasted an hour, I would still have... My mental calculation stopped as Elliot strode in, right on time. He cut across the lobby. Even at a distance, Elliot's eyes were sharp and piercing. They scanned the room slowly, almost too slowly, like a panther's eyes scouring the jungle floor. As he walked closer, he seemed to never blink. He spotted me and threw me a nod, then sat beside me. "Give me a second," he said without making eye contact. He took out his phone and typed away. 1 minute passed, then two, then... He glanced up and caught me staring at him. My eyes darted away. I checked my watch. We were 5 minutes into our meeting and we had barely spoken. As I snuck another look at Elliot, I couldn't help but smile when I saw his shoes. My prediction was right. I had noticed at USC during fraternity rush that students gravitate toward people they look similar to, which made me think that the more you look like the other person, the easier it is to strike up a friendship. So I spent some time that morning wondering what Elliot would wear. I put on blue jeans, a green V-neck shirt, and brown Tom's shoes, because I had read that the founder of Tom's went to summit events. Elliot was wearing gray jeans, a blue V-neck, and gray Tom's. But with his head down and his eyes glued to the screen, I felt that what I wore would be the last thing he'd notice. "You still in school?" he asked, not lifting his head. "Yeah, I'm a sophomore." "You gonna drop out?" "What?" "You heard what I said." My grandma's face flashed in my mind. "Junaman." "No," I blurted. No, I'm not." Elliot let out a soft laugh. "Okay, we'll see." I changed the subject. "So, I can tell you're really good at bringing people together and building momentum for your summit events. And I'm really curious how you do it. So, my one question for you is, you don't have to ask just one question." "Okay, so, I guess my first question is, what was the tipping point in your career that allowed you to build so much momentum?" "There is no tipping point," he said, still typing away. "It's all just little steps." To someone else, that might have been a good answer. But I had spent weeks dreaming of Elliot offering an entire monologue on the subject. So the fact he didn't give me more than a 5-word explanation made me feel like he was blowing me off. "Well, okay, so I guess my next question is, did you read the Star of Artaban chapter? Did you even open the book yet? Or can you not even handle reading 2 chapters on a day's notice?" "I read it," I said. "And I finished the whole book." Elliot finally looked up. He put his phone away. "Man, I was just like you when I was your age," he said. "I hustled just like you're hustling. And that cold email you sent me, you probably researched for a whole week to write that, huh?" "2 weeks. And then it took another 3 hours just trying to find your email address." "Yeah, man, I did that kind of stuff all the time." I finally relaxed, which was a mistake, because Elliot immediately turned on me, firing a machine gun of questions about the mission. He asked them so intensely, so rapidly, I felt I was being interrogated. I answered the best I could, unsure how our conversation was going. Elliot laughed when I told him about the time I crouched in the bathroom. He checked the time on his phone. "Listen," he said, "I only expected this to last 30 minutes, but maybe. Wait, don't you have class today?" "I'm all good. What do you have in mind?" "Well, if you want, You can stick around for a bit and sit in on my next meeting. That sounds amazing. Okay, cool, he said. But first, we need ground rules. These five things aren't just for today. They're for the rest of your life. He locked his eyes onto mine. Write these down. I took out my phone to type them into the notepad. Rule number one, never use your phone in a meeting. I don't care if you're just taking notes. Using your phone makes you look like a chump. Always carry a pen in your pocket. The more digital the world gets, the more impressive it is to use a pen. And anyway, if you're in a meeting, it's just rude to be on your phone. Rule number two, act like you belong. Walk into a room like you've been there before. Don't gawk over celebrities. Be cool, be calm, and never, ever ask someone for a picture. If you want to be treated like a peer, you need to act like one. Fans ask for pictures. Peers shake hands. Speaking of pictures, rule number three, mystery makes history. When you're doing cool shit, don't post pictures of it on Facebook. No one actually changing the world posts everything they do online. Keep people guessing what you're up to. Plus, the people you're going to impress by posting things online aren't the people you should care about impressing. Now, rule number four, he said, slowly stressing each word. This rule is the most important. If you break it, he moved his hand across his neck in a slicing motion. You're done. If you break my trust, you're finished. Never, ever go back on your word. If I tell you something in confidence, you need to be a vault. What goes in does not come out. This goes for your relationships with everyone from this day forward. If you act like a vault, people will treat you like a vault. It will take years to build your reputation, but seconds to ruin it. Understood? Understood. Good. He stood up and looked down at me. Get up. But I thought you said there were five rules. Oh yeah. Here's the last one. Adventures only happen to the adventurous. Before I could ask what that meant, Elliot walked away. I followed. He turned his head back to me. Ready to play with the big boys? I nodded. By the way, he added, looking me up and down. Nice Toms. Elliot's meeting began, and I found myself sitting with my forearms on my knees, listening more intently than I ever had to a professor in class. Elliot started it casually, making jokes and asking his guest how her morning was going. Then, almost unnoticeably, he shifted the full force of his focus on her. What was she passionate about? What was she working on? When she was polite and asked Elliot about himself, he laughed and said, "Oh, I'm not that interesting," and posed another question. For essentially the entire interaction, Elliot barely spoke about himself. Finally, at what seemed like the last 10% of the meeting, Elliot shared his story. The city of my dreams didn't exist, so I'm setting out to build it. He was buying the largest private ski mountain in North America in a city called Eden, Utah, and creating a small residential community on the backside of the mountain for entrepreneurs, artists, and activists. Then, just as she was hooked, Elliot ended the conversation. He gave her a hug and she headed off. Then another guest arrived. The second meeting flowed just as smoothly as the first. I was mesmerized by how Elliot controlled their interaction. I didn't want to take my eyes off him, yet I kept sneaking looks at my watch. I had to be on the road within an hour. After the second meeting ended, Elliot stood up and motioned for me to do the same. Having fun, he asked. I let out a giant grin. Great, he said. You're gonna love this next one. I trailed close behind as he headed for the exit. All I could see in my mind was an enormous hourglass, the sand trickling down until my final exam. We crossed the street to the Westin Hotel, which wasn't just any hotel. This week, it was the main lodging for the TED conference, one of the most exclusive gatherings in the world. We made our way to the lobby restaurant. It was intimate, no more than 15 tables. Classical music played in the background, accented by the chimes of tiny spoons against porcelain cups. Elliot walked directly to the host. "Table for four, please." As we were escorted through the dining area, I figured I should tell Elliot that I might have to leave this meeting early, but right then, Elliot greeted a man at a nearby table. I recognized him instantly. Tony Hsieh, the CEO of Zappos. His book, Delivering Happiness, was still on the top row of my bookshelf. Elliot continued walking. "You see that guy over there?" Elliot whispered to me. "That's Larry Page, the CEO of Google. That guy to your left is Reid Hoffman. He's the founder of LinkedIn. Now look over there. That table in the far back, the guy with the glasses, he created Gmail. On your right, in the blue running shorts, that's Chad. He's the co-founder of YouTube." We got to our table and Elliot's guests arrived. First came Frank, the co-founder of Startup Weekend, one of the world's largest entrepreneurial organizations. Then Brad, the co-founder of Groupon, which at the time was valued at $13 billion. The three of them chatted. Throughout the meal, Elliot's gaze kept darting my way as if he was judging me. I couldn't tell if he wanted me to speak up more or if the one time I did was one too many. Halfway through breakfast, the co-founder of Groupon went to the restroom. Then the co-founder of Startup Weekend stepped to the side to take a call. Elliot turned to me and continued his interrogation. "So where are you getting your money from? How are you paying for all your travels?" I told him I was using the money I won on a game show. "You what?" he said. "Have you heard of The Price is Right?" "Everyone's heard of The Price is Right." "Well, last year, two nights before finals, I pulled an all-nighter and figured out how to hack the show. I went the next day, won a sailboat, sold it, and that's how I'm funding my mission." Elliot put his fork down. "Hold on. You're telling me that we've been together for 2 hours now, and you never told me that you funded your entire adventure by hacking a game show?" I shrugged. "You idiot," he said. He leaned in and lowered his voice, enunciating each word. "Never again will you sit in a meeting with someone and not tell them that. Your mission is nice, but this story tells me more about who you are than anything else you could possibly say. This story commands attention. Everybody has experiences in their lives. Some choose to make them into stories." I was so transfixed by Elliot's words, I barely noticed that his guests had sat back down. "Alex, tell them what you just told me," Elliot said. "Tell them how you funded your mission." I stumbled through the story. Despite my stutters, by the end, the dynamic of the table had changed. The co-founder of Groupon cut me off. "That's incredible." He spoke to me for the rest of breakfast, sharing his stories and advice, then giving me his email address and telling me to stay in touch. I snuck another look at my watch. If I didn't leave in a few minutes, I was dead. Excusing myself from the table, I stepped to the side and looked up the number for the USC Business School office. As the dial tone rang in my ear, I looked over my shoulder at all the CEOs and billionaires I had dreamed of learning from. A secretary picked up, and with an overwhelming sense of urgency, I blurted, "Patch me through to the dean." For some reason, she did. The business school's associate dean, not the film school dean who had stopped me with Spielberg, answered the phone. "It's Alex Benayan. I need to explain to you where I'm standing right now. Within 10 feet of me is..." And I went on to list everyone in my vicinity. I don't need to explain to you how rare of an opportunity this is. Now, I have an accounting final in an hour, and I would have to leave right this second to get to campus on time. I can't make this decision. You have to make this decision. And I need an answer within 30 seconds. She didn't respond. After 30 seconds, I asked if she was still there. You didn't hear this from me, she said, but email your professor tomorrow morning saying your flight from San Francisco to LA was delayed. You had no control over the matter, and that's why you missed the final. Click. She hung up. To this day, it's hard to fully express how grateful I am for what the associate dean did for me that morning. When I returned to the table, breakfast continued and the energy kept building. The co-founder of Groupon invited me to visit him in Chicago. Then Reid Hoffman stopped by our table. Eventually, Elliot's two guests left and I sat there, looking around the restaurant, taking it all in. "Hey, big shot," Elliot whispered. "You want to interview a tech mogul, don't you? There's the CEO of Google, 20 feet away from you. This is your chance. Go talk to him. Let's see what you got." A wave of panic washed over me. "If you want it," Elliot said, "there it is." I usually prepare for weeks before I ask someone for an interview. I don't know anything about him. I don't think this is such a good idea. "Do it." It was almost as if Elliot could smell the flinch. "Come on, tough guy," he went on. "Let's see what you got." I didn't move. "Come on, do it," he said, sounding like a drug dealer. With each sentence, his shoulders rose higher and chest grew broader, as if he was fueling off my discomfort. He bore into me with his panther-like eyes. "When it's in front of you," Elliot said, "make your move." Larry Page, the CEO of Google, pushed his chair back. I could barely feel my legs. Page began walking away. I stood up. I shadowed him out of the restaurant and down some stairs. He entered a restroom. I cringed. Not again. I stepped in and saw six urinals. Larry Page was at one end. The other five were empty. Without thinking, I chose the one farthest from him. As I stood there, I tried to come up with something clever to say, but all I could hear in my head was Elliot's voice. "When it's in front of you, make your move." Page stepped over to wash his hands. I followed, again choosing the farthest sink. The more I thought about failing, the more I failed. Page was drying his hands. I had to say something. "You're Larry Page, right?" "Yes." My face went blank. Page looked at me, confused, and then walked out. And that was that. I dragged my feet back to the breakfast table, where Elliot was waiting. I slumped in my seat. "What happened?" he asked.
Well...
"You've got a lot to learn." Chapter 10. Adventures only happen to the adventurous. Bill Gates' chief of staff had said I needed a publishing deal, so I set out to get one. I began Googling, and it didn't take me long to learn the basics. First, you write a book proposal, which you use to attract a literary agent, who then secures a publisher. Every blog post I read stressed that you can't land a deal with a major publisher without a literary agent. So the way I saw it was, no agent, no Bill Gates. I bought more than a dozen books about the process. How to write a book proposal, best-selling book proposals, bulletproof book proposals, and stacked them in a gigantic tower on my desk. As I plowed through them and started my proposal, I used the Tim Ferriss cold email template to reach out to dozens of best-selling authors for advice. And, miraculously, the guidance flooded in. They answered my questions over email, spoke with me on the phone, and some even met me in person. Their kindness blew me away, and they helped me understand the obstacles I was up against. I was a young, unknown writer with no prior experience, entering the publishing industry at a time when it was shrinking and difficult for even successful writers to get deals. Because of that, the authors I spoke to stressed how important it was to focus on marketing ideas, both in my proposal and when I spoke to agents. They told me to use every fact and statistic I could to prove the book would sell, because without proof, why would an agent waste his or her time? But first, I needed to figure out exactly which agents to approach. One author told me how. He said to buy 20 books similar to the one I wanted to write, study the acknowledgments, and make notes of whom the authors thanked as their agents. I spent weeks compiling my list, researching what other books the agents represented and determining which agent might be best. Then, one night in the storage closet, I grabbed a sheet of white printer paper, uncapped a thick black marker, and wrote across the top, "No agent, no Bill Gates." One by one, I scrawled the names of 20 agents, starting with my favorite and working my way down. I taped the list on the wall. After I finished my proposal, I began reaching out to them a few at a time. As sophomore year ended and summer began, their responses trickled in. "Books like this don't sell," one told me. I drew a line through her name. "I don't think we're a right fit," another said. I crossed him off too. "I'm not taking on additional clients." Each rejection stung more than the last. One day, as I racked my mind wondering what I was doing wrong, my phone buzzed on my desk. It was a text from Elliot. Just seeing his name made me immediately grab my phone. "I'm in LA. Come hang for a bit." Desperate for a break, I headed straight to Elliot's Santa Monica apartment. When I got there, I found him and his 24-year-old brother, Austin, on a couch, each with a laptop in hand. "Yo," I said. Elliot shot down my enthusiasm with a dismissive stare. He turned his attention back to his laptop. "We're going to Europe tonight," he said. "Oh, cool. What time are you guys going?" "We don't know yet. We just decided a minute ago. We're looking for tickets." How did he live like this? When my parents traveled, they planned 6 months in advance. My dad would give thick packets with photocopies of his passport, emergency contact numbers, and itinerary to 3 different people. "You should come with us," Elliot said. I assumed he was joking. "You have any big plans this weekend?" "Not really." "Good. Come with us." "Are you serious?" "Yes. Book your tickets right now." "There's no way my parents will let me go." "You're 19. Why do you need to ask your parents?" Clearly, Elliot had never met my mom. "Are you in?" he pressed. I can't. I have a family thing tonight." "Okay, fly out tomorrow morning. Meet us there." I didn't respond. "Are you in?" he repeated. My Price is Right money is low. I don't have enough cash for flights and hotels and all that. Get your plane tickets and I'll cover the rest." I ran out of excuses. "Great," he said. "You're coming with us." I hadn't made up my mind, but I didn't want to close off the possibility, so I nodded. "Perfect. Get on a flight tomorrow morning and meet us in London." "How am I going to find you?" "Just text me when you land. I'll send you the address. It's easy. Just get on the tube from the airport and I'll tell you which stop to get off." "What's the tube?" Elliot sneered. He turned to Austin. "Oh my God, how funny would it be if we tell him to meet us in London, but instead of being there, we leave him a note with a riddle that tells him we're now in Amsterdam. Then he goes there and finds another riddle that tells him we're now in Berlin, and then another and another." My face went flush. We're kidding," Elliot said. He looked at Austin and they laughed hysterically. I headed to Shabbat dinner at my grandma's house, which is far from a calm family gathering. It's 30 cousins, uncles, and aunts all around a table, shouting on top of each other, which is why I knew better than to tell my mom about Europe during dinner. After our meal, I asked my mom if we could talk in a side room. We closed the door and I told her about Elliot, why I so desperately wanted to learn from him, and how our first meeting went. "Wow," she said. "That's so nice." Then I told her I was meeting him in London the next day. "What do you mean you're meeting him in London? You're pulling my leg. You don't even know this guy." "I do know him. And he's not just some guy. He's well known in the business world." She Googled Elliot on her phone, which I quickly remembered was a bad idea.
What are all these pictures?
Well,
where's his home? Why doesn't his website say what he does?
Mom, you don't understand. Mystery makes history.
Mystery makes history? Are you insane? What if you fly to London and Mr. Mystery isn't there? Where are you even going to stay?
Elliot said he'd text me when I land.
He'll text you when you land? You are insane. I don't have the energy for this. You're not going.
Mom, I thought it through. Worst case scenario is he dishes me and I'll just book a return ticket and I'll have wasted my Price is Right money. But the best case scenario is maybe he'll become my mentor.
No. The worst case is he doesn't ditch you. And once you're with him, you don't know what he pressures you to do. You don't know where he takes you. You don't know what kind of people he hangs out with.
Mom, listen.
No, you listen. Look at yourself. You met some guy and he told you to meet him in London the next day? And you said yes? Have we taught you nothing? Where's your common sense? Did you ever stop and ask yourself why Elliot never stays put in any one city? Why does he buy his plane tickets only a few hours in advance? What is he running away from? And why does he want a 19-year-old to come with him? What's his agenda?
I didn't have an answer, but something inside of me said it didn't matter.
Mom, I won this money. It's my decision. I'm going.
Her face flashed red.
We'll talk in the morning.
Late that night, through my bedroom walls, I could hear my mom crying on the phone to my grandma.
I don't know what to do with him anymore, my mom said. He's out of control.
The next morning, I found her in the kitchen. I showed her my laptop and told her, if I was going to make it to London, I had to buy my ticket in the next 2 hours. The time pressure didn't persuade her.
Our talk from the night before played out again, and, as happens in many Persian families, it was only a matter of time before our one-on-one conversation turned into a circus. My sisters, Tali and Brianna, appeared in their pajamas and immediately started arguing for both sides, yelling over each other. My dad walked in completely confused and started shouting, "Who is Elliot? Who is Elliot?" The doorbell rang and it was my grandma holding a Tupperware of peeled cucumbers asking if we'd made a decision. 15 minutes before the cutoff, my mom still hadn't budged. I told her that as much as I loved her, I had to make this decision for myself. Right as she began to respond, my grandma cut her off.
"Enough," she said. "He's a good kid. Let him go." The kitchen fell silent. My mom reached for my laptop. When I looked at the screen, she was helping me book my ticket.
Chapter 11. Bite off more than you can chew. One day later, rooftop in London. I didn't think places like this actually existed. There were dozens, no, hundreds of tall, beautiful women in bikinis with the kind of curves that melt the mind of a kid who can't even get into a frat party. They were shoulder to shoulder in the swimming pool, overflowing onto the deck, bathing in the bright summer sun. All I heard were the sounds of giggling and splashing and popping champagne bottles. Elliot reclined in a pool chair to my right, his hair dripping wet from a recent dip. Austin sat beside him, strumming a guitar.
"So," I said to Elliot, "this is what it's like being an entrepreneur?"
"Not in the slightest," he replied.
He told me he barely knew what the word entrepreneur meant when he started college. The concept first clicked during his freshman year. Elliot was walking down his dorm room hall when he saw steam creeping out from under a doorway. He stumbled in and saw that his friend had converted his room into a makeshift t-shirt factory.
"What are you doing?" Elliot asked.
His friend explained how screen printing worked.
"Cool," Elliot said. "Who do you work for?"
"Nobody."
"What do you mean, nobody? What company hires you?"
"No company."
"You can't just work for nobody. Then who pays you?"
"The people I sell the shirts to pay me."
"I literally don't understand.
You don't have a boss or an office. How can you... Dude, it's called being an entrepreneur. You can do that. It seems so simple. Here's this kid. He made a t-shirt, and then somebody bought it for $20. Plus, no boss? To Elliot, that was a dream. But he didn't have any ideas of his own, so Elliot figured he should just make t-shirts too. He asked his friend if they could partner, and boxes of unsold t-shirts later, they gave up. The following year, they created a marketing consulting company for stores neighboring their campus. After 9 months of pitching every shop, no one hired them. When he went back home to Washington, D.C. for the summer, he learned that his dad had started an email newsletter on local real estate. "Why don't I sell ads for it?" Elliot wondered. His dad said no. At the time, Elliot was just a college kid with 2 failed businesses to his name. But after some convincing, his dad finally gave in and Elliot got to work. He picked up the local newspaper, turned to the real estate section, saw which companies were buying ads, and called the first one. "Hi, I'd love to sell you some advertising. Who should I talk to?" "Sorry, we're not interested." Click. He dialed the next one. "Hi, who buys your advertising?" "Oh, our marketing director." "Oh, great, I'd love to talk to them." "Sorry, not interested." Click. Elliot called another. "Hi, who's your marketing director?" "Sarah Smith." "Oh, can I talk to her?" "Nope." Click. Elliot made a note to call her back. A week later, he called again in his most professional voice and said, "Hello, this is Elliot Bisno for Sarah Smith, please. 1 second," and he was patched right through. After 3 weeks of cold calls, Elliot finally booked his first sales meeting at the DC office of Jones Lang LaSalle, a large real estate firm. Elliot had once heard that if you present 3 pricing options and make the first option too expensive and the third unappealing, people often choose the middle one. So he made a gold, silver, and bronze package, with silver being 10 ads for $6,000. There was no science behind his pricing. It just sounded right. Elliot went to the meeting and made his pitch. Sure enough, the man said, "We'd like to go with the silver package." Now Elliot had no idea what to do. Okay, great, Elliot said, trying to sound professional. "So, just to make sure, how do you feel most comfortable with a follow-up? What do you like to see when you're a new client from someone?" "Well, they send me an insertion order." "Absolutely," Elliot said. He wrote down "send insertion order" and Googled it when he got home. Elliot hit the phones every day that summer, selling $30,000 worth of ads. He made 20% commission, which put $6,000 in his pocket. After returning to college for his junior year, he woke up at 5 o'clock every morning to sell ads. Through sheer practice, he became a cold calling expert. He made $20,000 sales, $50,000 sales, and a few $100,000 sales. He took a semester off from school, then another, eventually dropping out. During the early years of his company, BizNow Media, Elliot went on to sell $1 million worth of ads. "It's not rocket science," Elliot told me, sitting up in his pool chair. "And it's not as complicated as all those business books make it seem, huh?" I nodded, then admitted to Elliot that sometimes when I cold called someone, I'd get so nervous I'd forget what to say. "It's because you're overthinking it," he said. "Just tell yourself you're calling your friend. Dial the number and start talking right away. The best cure for nervousness is immediate action." Immediate action was at the core of Elliot's life. That, plus relentless hard work, added up over time. Just 10 years after Elliot sold his first ad, he and his dad would sell BizNow Media to a private equity firm for $50 million in cash. "Wait," I said to Elliot, shading my eyes from the sun. "If you were spending all your time cold calling, how did you have time to start Summit?" "It just started as a side project," he said. After dropping out of school, Elliot didn't know any people his age in the business world. He wanted not only to make new friends, but also create relationships with people he could learn from. So Elliot cold called some young entrepreneurs he'd read about in a magazine and asked, "What if we get a bunch of us together and just hang out for a weekend?"
He rallied the founders of College Humor, Tom Shoes, Thrillist, and more than a dozen other entrepreneurs, and they all went skiing for a weekend on Elliot's dime. Elliot even paid for their flights. Of course, he didn't actually have that kind of money, so he put the $30,000 cost of the trip on a credit card and gave himself until the end of the month to pay it off. He then did what he knew best. Elliot cold called companies and asked if they wanted to sponsor a conference of 20 of the greatest young entrepreneurs in America, and they said yes. My mom helped me book the cabin, I rented a few cars, and once everyone was there, it kind of took care of itself, Elliot said. I remember asking my mom, what should I get for these people, like apples or granola bars? What kind of granola bars? How do you even get granola bars? I had no idea what I was doing. Ever since then, I've lived my life by one motto. Bite off more than you can chew. You can figure out how to chew later. Elliot fanned his face with a cocktail menu and looked around the pool deck. It's a bit too hot here. He took out his iPhone, opened the weather app, and began flicking through major cities in Europe. 91 degrees in Paris? Nope. 87 in Berlin? Nope. 85 in Madrid? Nope. Elliot reclined in his chair, chin tilted high, flicking through cities as if he were Zeus on Mount Olympus. Ah, yes, he said. Barcelona, 71 and sunny. He opened another app, bought 3 plane tickets, and we were out the door. Chapter 12. That's how you do business. 8 hours later, nightclub in Barcelona. Music blared as 7 waitresses paraded toward us, firecrackers in one hand, giant bottles of vodka in the other. 7 bottles, 6 of us. Whenever someone handed Elliot a shot, he'd smile, say cheers, and as everyone downed their drinks, he'd pour his into a potted plant on his left. Our plane had landed 3 hours earlier. In the hotel lobby, Elliot had bumped into a Peruvian media mogul he knew who invited us to a party at the hotel's nightclub. When we arrived at his table, Elliot had me sit next to the media mogul and tell the Price is Right story. As I said it, the man's eyes wandered. Elliot then jumped in and guided the story, interjecting funny details I forgot to include, and by the end we were all laughing and the man asked for my email address to stay in touch. Then Elliot pointed to another guy at the table. Alex, tell him the story. I did, and once I finished, Elliot pointed to someone else. Now tell him. He continued pointing. Tell it again. Tell it again. Elliot started pointing to complete strangers. The more uncomfortable the situation, the better I became. Each repetition wore down the flinch. At a certain point, I could barely feel it. This is what you don't understand, Elliot told me. You probably think everyone loves your story because you were on a game show. But what your story is about isn't as important as how you tell it. It was now 2 hours past midnight. I was watching Elliot mingle with the other people at our table. In my business classes, we were taught to be professional with new contacts, exchange business cards, email rather than text. Elliot did the opposite. But this wasn't a skill he was born with, he told me. As we stepped out to the balcony of the nightclub, Elliot admitted that he didn't have many friends growing up. He was short and chubby, and at school, he felt invisible. Bullies called him Midget. They pronounced his last name as Big Nose rather than Bizno. The one place he felt safe was on the tennis court. Elliot decided to leave high school during junior year and enroll in a tennis academy. When he got to college, his social life wasn't much better. Most people didn't want to hang out with him or invite him to parties. He eventually got a girlfriend, but she soon broke up with him because she thought it was weird that he woke up so early to make cold calls. When Elliot left college, his social awkwardness stayed with him. He collected so many business cards and networking events that he had to use shoeboxes to store them all. But one night, around that time, Elliot learned his lesson. he put on a suit and tie and met a potential advertising client at a steakhouse. Elliot was nervous. This was the first time he was taking a meeting outside of an office. When Elliot greeted the client, the man looked at him and shook his head.
"Elliot, take off your jacket. Take it off. Now, take off your tie. Roll up your sleeves. Grab a seat."
Elliot had reserved a table in the corner. The client said they weren't sitting there. He led Elliot to the bar.
"Ma'am, we'd like 2 orders of cheesy fries and a beer."
I thought we're having a business meeting," Elliot said.
"Relax. So, tell me about yourself."
They exchanged stories, joked around, and Elliot realized they actually had a lot in common. After an hour of getting to know each other, the man put down his drink and said,
"All right, what do you want to sell me?"
"Well," Elliot said, "I'd love to do this and this at this price."
"Well, I'd like to do it at this price, and I'd like to do it like this. Will that work?
Could we change this a little?"
"Absolutely," the man said. "Does that sound good?"
"Sounds great." They shook hands and closed a $16,000 deal. They hung out for another hour, and then, as they were getting up from the bar, the man looked at Elliot and said,
"Kid, that's how you do business."
Elliot and I left the nightclub and headed to our room.
"I didn't think you'd actually come," Elliot said as we stepped down the hallway.
"What do you mean?"
"When I said you should come with us to Europe, you hesitated. I'm surprised you actually came. Why'd you do it?"
"Well, I just thought about it logically," I said. "The best case scenario was that I would have a great learning experience with you. The worst case scenario was that I would lose some money, which would have hurt, but life would go on, you know?"
Elliot stopped walking.
He looked me in the eyes, but didn't say a word. Then he just continued moving. Minutes later, Austin joined us in the room, and we got ready to sleep. Elliot was in one bed, Austin in the other, and I was on a rollaway tucked next to the bathroom sink. I hit the lights. A bit later, I heard Elliot's voice whispering,
"Alex, you awake?"
I was exhausted and not in the mood to talk, so I stayed quiet. 30 seconds later, I heard him whispering to the other side of the room.
"Austin,"
Elliot said, with a smile I could hear through the dark. There was a rustle in the sheets.
"Austin, he's one of us."
Chapter 13, Exponential Life.
"Tell him the Hampton story," Austin said, egging Elliot on.
We were having lunch the following afternoon at a sidewalk cafe along Barcelona's La Rambla, and, surprisingly, feeling extremely well-rested. Elliot had insisted we all get a full 8 hours of sleep, do yoga in the morning, and get a few hours of work done before leaving the hotel. He didn't drink or smoke, and he took conference calls while we walked the streets. His life was a lot more balanced behind the scenes than he made it seem.
"Oh man, the Hampton story," Elliot said. "Alex, you're gonna love this one."
A year after he left college, Elliot had heard about a tennis pro-am in the Hamptons. To play, non-professionals like Elliot had to donate $4,000 to charity. Elliot knew a wealthy individual from Washington, D.C., flying there on a private jet and wanted to go with him.
"Even though I didn't have much money," Elliot said, "I decided to make the donation and play in the pro-am anyway because I thought, if I do that, then I'll be a baller. And then I'll fly on a private plane, get to the Hamptons, be in the tournament, everyone will think I'm super legit, and then I'll take it from there."
Over the course of the 3-day tournament, people he met asked what he planned to do for the rest of the week. Elliot said he planned on staying in the Hamptons, which he actually hadn't, but he didn't have a place to stay, prompting those he was talking with to say,
"Oh, you should stay with me."
And Elliot innocently replied,
"Gosh, I'd love to stay with you. That's so kind. Thank you for offering."
By the end of his trip, one guy loaned Elliot his Aston Martin to drive around. He was sleeping in mansions and watching Yankees games on TV with one of the owners of the team.
"I was backpacking through the Hamptons," Elliot told me, "and I was just in it.
It turned into a 3-week adventure. At the tournament, he met a Goldman Sachs executive who said he might be able to get his firm to sponsor the second summit event. Elliot told him Goldman didn't even have to pay, as long as Elliot could use the firm's logo on the sponsors page of the event website. Elliot then called other companies and said, "Look, it's almost impossible to get to be a sponsor of Summit right now. We're working with very few companies, and our most recent client is Goldman Sachs. So if you want to be serious, let's be serious. We're only working with the best." It was another example of borrowed credibility. That Goldman Sachs relationship enabled Elliot to lock in other sponsors, which led to a lot of the eventual success of Summit. The point of the story is less about throwing money around and more about personal investing, Elliot told me. You have to make a calculated judgment that the amount of money you're going to put in is either going to pay off way bigger in the long term or enough in the short term to offset your costs. Aside from the money you live on, the rest is your money to play the game. As our lunch continued, one word kept coming back to me. Momentum. How did Summit go from this small ski trip to being called a gift to the United States by President Clinton? I felt I was missing a piece of the puzzle, so I pressed Elliot about Summit's early days. Elliot said that a few years after his first Summit, he read Tim Ferriss's The 4-Hour Workweek, sold all of his possessions, left day-to-day operations of Bizno Media, and traveled the world, living between Nicaragua, Tel Aviv, and Amsterdam. Around that time, he flew home to see his parents in D.C. and went to a party where he met a man named Yossi Sirgant, the co-creator of the Obama Hope campaign with Shepard Fairey. The Obama administration had tasked Yossi with inviting young entrepreneurs to the White House. And when Elliot told Yossi about Summit, Yossi asked if he would host an event at the White House. Elliot didn't know if he could pull it off or not, but he said yes anyway. He assumed he could just figure it out. Yossi called a week later. "We're set for the event. It's on Friday." "Which Friday?" Elliot asked. "Next Friday." "That's impossible. I'll be in, and we need all their social security numbers and names by Tuesday at noon. Bring 35 people." "But how are we going to get people to say yes in just 4 days?" "Just tell them. When the White House calls, you answer." So Elliot started calling people he had met planning earlier summit events, and they connected him with other entrepreneurs, from the co-founder of Twitter to the CEO of Zappos. Elliot called them up using his most official-sounding voice. "Hello, this is Elliot Bizno from Summit Series. I have a mandate from the White House. I'm organizing a group on behalf of the Executive Office of the President, and we'd like to have so-and-so there." Yossi insisted that the founders of Method, the eco-friendly soaps, be at the event. So Elliot called their office. "Hello, it's Elliot Bizno for Eric Ryan and Adam Lowry. I need to speak to their assistant immediately." He got through. "How can I help you?" "I'm calling on behalf of the President of the United States of America. The presence of Mr. Ryan and Mr. Lowry has been requested at the White House next Friday." "Well, that's very gracious of you, but that's impossible. They're doing a huge paid speaking engagement next Friday." "Ma'am," Elliot said, lowering his voice, "when the White House calls, you answer." And just like that, he got them to cancel their paid speaking gig. A few days before the event, Elliot found out that Yossi wasn't actually planning as high-level an event as he'd assumed. To avoid looking like a fool in front of his new entrepreneur friends, Elliot cold-called the White House offices, spreading a whisper campaign amongst the senior administration that they weren't invited to this exclusive event, so they would reflexively demand to be there. Elliot told them, "I don't know if you've heard, but all the leading young entrepreneurs in America are coming to the White House, and everybody who's anybody was invited." And it worked. The people who put together the stimulus package, the staff of the National Economic Council, the environmental team, they all showed up. It reached the point that Rahm Emanuel, Obama's chief of staff, called Yossi screaming about why he wasn't invited. The event went so well that word began to spread about Summit, And eventually, the Clinton Foundation called Elliot and asked him to host a fundraiser. Later, the summit team planned another event in D.C., this time with 750 people. The next one took place on a cruise ship in the Caribbean with 1,000 people. The events continued swelling in popularity, the following one at a ski resort in Lake Tahoe. Now Elliot was buying a private mountain in Eden, Utah, to make it the home of the summit community. "I could have told Yossi, 'I don't think we can pull it off,' or 'Let's do it in a month,' Elliot told me. At the end of the day, Yossi said he wanted on Friday, and we said yes. I've learned that you have to go for it, even if there's a chance you'll fail. The planets are never going to perfectly align. When you see an opportunity, it's up to you to jump." 4 days later, New York City. "What I'm about to tell you," Elliot told me, "99% of people in the world will never understand." For the first time all week, it was just the two of us. Elliot had told Austin he wanted to talk to me one-on-one. We were standing on a rooftop lounge during sunset, looking out at the Manhattan skyline. "You see, most people live a linear life," he continued. "They go to college, get an internship, graduate, land a job, get a promotion, save up for a vacation each year, work toward their next promotion, and they just do that their whole lives. Their lives move step by step, slowly and predictably. But successful people don't buy into that model. They opt into an exponential life. Rather than going step by step, they skip steps. People say that first you need to pay your dues and get years of experience before you can go out on your own and get what you truly want. Society feeds us this lie that you need to do XYZ before you can achieve your dream. It's bullshit. The only person whose permission you need to live an exponential life is your own. Sometimes an exponential life lands on your lap, like with a child prodigy. But most of the time, for people like you and me, we have to seize it for ourselves. If you actually want to make a difference in the world, if you want to live a life of inspiration, adventure, and wild success, you need to grab on to that exponential life and hold on to it with all you've got." I looked at him, nodding my head, mesmerized. "You want that?" he asked. Every fiber in my body pulsed with yes. But Elliot didn't wait for my answer. "All right, let's get to the point. You're making a huge mistake." "What?" "You're not going to stay 19 forever. You can't live off of game show money the rest of your life. You need to stop focusing all your time on getting these silly interviews. There needs to be a point in your life where you step it up. I think you're ready. Quit your mission and come work for me." I didn't respond. "Look," he said, "the mission is nice and all, and I'm not trying to insult it, but it's not a career. It brought you to this point. Congratulations, you got what you wanted. You were lost, and now you have a sense of direction. It's time for you to go to the next level. There's no money in writing. The money is in business. And I'm willing to give you a fast pass. Skip the line and join me at the front. It's time for you to get in the game." Can I have some time to think about it? What is there to think about? I'll pay you more than you'd ever want. I'll teach you more than you'd ever need to know. And I'll take you more places than you ever thought existed." "That's seriously amazing," I said, measuring my words. "But the mission is really important to me and..." "Fine. Email me the list of people you want to interview. I'll get you all of them. We can get a ghostwriter to put it together and you can start working for me next week." Elliot waited for my response, but no words came to me. "If you don't take this," he said, "you're making the biggest mistake of your life. Tell me another time someone will offer you an opportunity like this. And you don't have to climb up the ladder. I'll take you under my wing and bring you to the top. Everything you dreamed about in your dorm room, I'll give you right now. Stop chasing interviews, ditch the mission, and work with me. What do you say?" Chapter 14. the avoidance list. One day later, Eden, Utah. Fields of grass and old wooden shacks flicked by the window of my rental car. Elliot lived in a town called Eden. Population, 600. If I accepted his offer, this would be my new home. An hour north of Salt Lake City, off a one-lane road. I'm not a wooden shack kind of guy. But I'd be crazy to say no to him. Working with him would change everything. It was Friday, and Elliot wanted an answer by the end of the weekend. Driving farther, I turned a corner, pulled into a long driveway, and that's when I saw it. A massive, mansion-sized log cabin. It sat beside a glistening lake, backdropped by thick evergreen trees and a towering mountain range. The front lawn was the size of a football field. This was Elliot's house. We had taken separate flights from New York that morning. I walked into his home and found Elliot in the vast living room. "This house is unreal," I said. Elliot grinned. "Just wait till you see what we build on the mountain." He explained that this was just a temporary home where he and his dozen employees lived and held summit events. This weekend, he was hosting 100 attendees who were housed in smaller cabins a few miles away. Elliot was still in the process of buying Powder Mountain, which was 10 miles to the north. On its backside, he was building his entrepreneurial utopia. "Grab some food and make yourself at home," Elliot said, and before I responded, he was already gone, greeting another guest. I made my way to the kitchen and was overcome by aromas so tantalizing they made me never want to set foot again in my college dining hall. Three private chefs were setting out overflowing trays of scrambled eggs, fried eggs, poached eggs, sizzling bacon, stacks of fluffy blueberry pancakes, rows of caramel French toast, giant bowls of chia pudding, berry parfait, and smashed avocado drizzled with olive oil and Himalayan salt. There was a long counter covered in mounds of bagels and breads and frosted homemade cinnamon rolls. A whole other counter with freshly cut fruits and vegetables that were grown on the farm next door. "Hello, Eden!" I filled my plate to the brim and took a seat next to a man eating alone. He had long hair and tattoos running up his arms. Within minutes, we were talking as if we'd known each other for years. The man told me stories about surfing in shark-infested waters, and we spoke for the rest of the hour. We exchanged info and agreed to meet again in L.A. I later found out he was the lead singer of Incubus, the multi-platinum rock band. Another person joined our table, a former host of MTV's TRL. Then another pulled up a seat, one of Barack Obama's economic advisors. And this was just me trying to eat some breakfast. I spotted Elliot looking down at us from a railing on the cabin's second floor. He pointed at me and yelled, "There's my favorite college dropout!" I cringed. My grandma's voice echoed in my head. "Junaman." My mood later bounced back when I stepped outside and spotted a chalkboard listing the day's activities. There was yoga, hiking, horseback riding, mountain biking, volleyball, ultimate frisbee, meditation, ATVing, and skydiving. I could attend a survival course with a wilderness expert or a writing workshop with a national poetry slam champion. I dashed over to the volleyball game, and one of the players on my team was the neuroscientist whose TED Talk I'd watched in biology class a year earlier. Then I hopped on a trampoline and the woman who joined me was Miss USA 2009. I went over to the meditation circle and sitting to my left was a former NFL player. To my right, a Native American shaman. I kept running around all afternoon feeling like Harry Potter on his first day of Hogwarts. Whenever Elliot saw I wasn't talking to someone, he'd put his arm around me and introduce me to someone else. I was in a pinball machine of inspiration, bouncing off the bumper, scoring 1,000 points a minute. Everything about this place just seemed to be more. The people's energy was more vibrant, their laughs more contagious, their careers more interesting, their stories more exhilarating. Even the sky seemed bluer here. When I'd been lying on my dorm room bed, I felt I was suffocating. Here, I could breathe. As the sun slowly set, we went inside for dinner, where the living room had been transformed into a 5-star dining room.
this wasn't typical luxury. It was more like if the Ritz-Carlton was run by Paul Bunyan. Sparkling wine glasses were placed beside rustic mesas.